pleased to welcome you this evening for this Lisi seminar. We have Professor Mikhail Arandarenko from Belgrade, who's a professor of labour economics at the Faculty of Economics and vice dean for international cooperation at the Faculty of Economics. He's currently chair of the board of FREN, the Foundation for the Advancement of Economics, which is a think tank, a research unit devoted to promoting research on economics in Serbia with a strong focus on policy research and providing evidence for policymakers in Serbia. His research areas include labour markets, employment programmes, industrial relations and social policy. And he's published several books, including The Labour Market in Serbia, Trends, Institutions and Policies in 2011, and Mapping the Serbian Labour Market in 2006. Outside the university, he's a member of the... he's very active in various policy fora. He's a member of the Employment Council of Serbia, and he is the national correspondent for the European Employment Observatory. He's also been a consultant for various international organisations, including the World Bank and the OECD and others. Mikhail has been actively involved in providing policy advice in Serbia. For example, he was chairman of the task force on the national employment strategy and in other ways. So I can't think of anybody really more qualified to talk about today's topic, which is the political economy of unemployment in the Western Balkans.
Mikhail. Thank you very much, Phil. Well, I'd first like to thank the European Institute and Lisi for offering me this visiting fellowship and enabling me to spend this semester in this inspiring and friendly environment of the London School of Economics. I'm also grateful for the opportunity to have this seminar and then test some of the ideas and I dare say theories that I have on the labor markets in the Western Balkans. So I'll just try to stick to the 45 minutes, right? So the goal of basically, they can call it my research here, would be to try to sketch a framework for better understanding of labor markets in the Western Balkans. And it should be informed by a really fastly growing body of labor market research, including the impetus that that it has from the Lisi Research Network on labor markets. Then also, there is a growing number of diagnostic policy studies, but also of the policy recommendations of international organizations and now regular periodic assessments of the European Union. And then also this sketch will be informed by my own insights on growth and employment policies of individual governments in the region. I had the opportunity to work in almost all of them except Albania and Kosovo. So the structure will be of the talk or the presentation will be the brief overview of labor markets in the Western Balkans. Then we will go briefly through the really diverse set of explanations for the uniquely poor labor market performance in the region. Then also through the set of newest recommendations from international organizations mostly. Then also we'll briefly go through the government policies with regard to tackling labor market crisis in the region, and then I will try to sketch this political economy model, or more modestly said, sketch of a framework of unemployment in the Western Balkans. So, first, the things that you all know quite well: labor market performance of the region is worst in Europe. This shouldn't be a surprise. Western Balkans has been referred to as super periphery of Europe, or the backwaters, backyard of its least developed part, and still not capable, according to the official assessments, of meeting Copenhagen criteria. But more surprisingly, labor market indicators are worst in the world, and we will quickly go through it in some of the later slides. Then also, shares of vulnerable and informal employment. These are measures. Labor market indicators refer to, of course, three major complementary measures, quantitative measures, that is participation or activity rate, employment and unemployment rate. But there are also additional measures of labor quality and proxy for the, let's say, better quality of labor would be if the shares of vulnerable and informal employment are low. And vulnerable employment means self-employment and employment of helping family members, most often not paid, unpaid. And then again, labor markets come as having quite a modest quality, with informal employment even surpassing 50% of total employment in Albania, and well above the levels in, of course, developed countries. So just to go briefly through the indicators, what is best known to let's say non-specialists is unemployment rate, the indicator best known to them. And then these are some really disturbing facts about most of the countries: around 20% for those which are let's say more successful, and 30% for those who are less. But then even more worrying is very low employment rate, which in the case of Kosovo comes as low as below 30%, and this is for working age population, and this is the World Bank stat, basically World Bank organized, conducted labor force survey. So the data include informal employment. I'm sure that they're not happy about the results and the quality of the data, and that could be debated, but this is what we have, and we have actually consistently extremely low indicators. For example, activity rate for the adult population defined as 15 and more is less than half in some, is around half. So it means that every second adult is either employed or unemployed, and that inactivity is actually prevalent in the region. Looking at the world as a whole, and these are the ILO data, the most recent, looking at the world as a whole and at some of the world regions, we see huge gap. For example, the employment to population ratio is almost half of that found in East and Southeast Asia, and well below world average, and also very much below advanced economies and the EU. And what we see is actually that the closest region to Western Balkans is Middle East and North Africa, the region that that recently had a series of uprisings that initially started as rebellions against the lack of jobs in Tunisia. And that region is Middle East and North Africa, but as you can see, the percentages are much better there than in the Western Balkans. This is a neat graph, a little bit complex, but it also gives a synthetic measure of non-employment, which is basically unemployment, so those who seek job but cannot find them, and inactivity, those who do not even look for a job for various reasons. But this is that measure of basically waste of human capital, and we again see that Western Balkans countries come very, very high in the right-hand side, Serbia, Macedonia, and we now know, because not all countries are included, that Bosnia fits there, and Kosovo surpasses every other country, of course. And this despite the fact that the graph is not quite fair, in the sense that it is not corrected for childbearing, so it means that the countries with much higher fertility are actually let's say worse in this ranking, and also does not include cultural factors in some of the countries in the Middle and in the Near and Middle East. Of course, there is basically cultural impediments to female participation in the labor market. Okay, so this is my effort to emulate the a German historian who listed 210 reasons for the fall of Rome. My favorite is warm baths, but there are many others. But among the reasons which indeed include impact policies of the governments, indeed are immigrants and Chinese, however, you know, ridiculous that might look, but yes, these are the worries that sometimes are mentioned when high unemployment is discussed. We will get to this, but this is just to basically illustrate that there is a need to organize this in a sense, to try to group the factors that really make this region so uniquely bad when it comes to labor market performance. So I've tried to do this simply by grouping them into objective and subjective factors, objective being those that are allegedly not that we cannot that policies cannot actually impact them, or only to a limited degree. The first one would be the stage of the development. I'll get to this soon. Then demographic factors, including cultural patterns, but also migrations. So this is one important thing. Historical legacy, including socialism and conflicts. And then the subjective factors would be related to the failed transition process and the failed development and growth strategies or lack of them, wrong policies. Then also, as a basically not quite different thing, inadequate economic and labor market institutions which reduce potential employment levels. So what would be the explanation based on the combination of stage of development and transition factors? One can posit so let's call it employment U-curve hypothesis across the stages of development, which would imply, because employment is sort of a very rough and ambiguous state. It could be employment or jobs could be so-called subsistence jobs, and they could be really good jobs based on investment in human capital and high technology. So it comes as no surprise that actually, or it comes as a surprise for sometimes to see that the most that the countries with the best labor market performance are those which are least developed, because everyone there has to work, including children, as you sometimes hear, especially in South and East Asia. And then there are countries in which jobs increasingly, or employment increasingly are sort of a challenge and a good thing to spend time in. So these are the most advanced countries. And then those in between are at some point stuck in the fact that there is not enough good jobs, and that still there is enough income to support inactivity, basically, of family members. So at that, mid-income countries are often found in that bottom of that U-curve of development. But even if you look at that, if we accept this hypothesis, and it could be illustrated as roughly true, with the bottom really being somewhere in the middle income region, Western Balkan countries are actually, when it comes to income, they belong in the upper middle income group, all of them. Albania joined most recently, except perhaps Kosovo. It's still, of course, because also the lack of reliable data, it's not quite clear, but Kosovo is clearly the poorest among them. So they would have already, or should have already, moved from that bottom to actually an increasing part of that U-curve. Increasing section of it. But of course then the transition comes in, and we can ascribe that, let's say, additional problematic feature of the Western Balkan countries to the failed transition, and to the fact that actually job destruction that is supposed to be the most important challenge of the early stage of transition was never matched, or has never been matched, by job creation, and that the failure of job creation is something that in this region that is really the most dramatic or unfortunate point in the developments in the labor market. And so the relative size of modern labor market, that, let's call it, wage, private sector wage employment part, as something that should be driving everything else, is not growing or is shrinking. And then what increases or is both, at least in relative terms, traditional employment, so agricultural and employment and self-employment, and also non-employment, either as inactivity or as unemployment. So there have been several explanations offered for the transition failure. One can group them into, let's say, objective and subjective again. We can say that, of course, the Western Balkans is basically, as a small, poor region, under ideal conditions, it would never be overly attractive to foreign investment. But then when we add that they were latecomers in transition, that, you know, in the prosperous 90s, the bulk of the FDIs went to the Central and Eastern Europe, then that they are also post-conflict and in some aspects conflict countries still, there is a poor infrastructure, internal markets are small, so there is no wonder that all these circumstances have led to the failure of transition. But then, of course, one can add also criticism with regards to the growth models that were pursued or policies that were pursued, including, of course, the failure of consumption-oriented growth model. So the idea that that was prevalent in the first half of the 2000s, I mean, up to 2008, that if wages are increased, often using privatization proceeds, so that would help internal the development of internal market, and that would boost gradually the not only the standard of living but also the industrial production and growth, and the idea was that actually manufacturing is not that important, that basically the region has nothing to offer in that regard, and especially, you know, in small countries there are always ideas that they would be able to live on services, construction, and then that basically that would be the way to get out of transition. Industrialization has led to the actually has confirmed in a negative way Kaldor's first growth law, and that is that manufacturing at the modest level of economic development should serve as an engine of growth. Another important factor which will play even more important role toward the end of my presentation is related to labor migration and brain drain in the region, and we see the red red columns are those belonging to Western Balkan countries, either as a stock of permanent emigrants or share of brain drain in among the emigrants. So we see again that Western Balkans has a far larger emigration. Also, it is differentiated within itself, in the sense that there is a old wave of guest workers from 60s and 70s, only from former Yugoslavia, but then there is also conflict emigration or post-conflict immigration that's especially prominent with Bosnia, and then economic immigration, which also the newer economic immigration, which also could be divided into two types. One, let's say, standard guest workers of the old type, and another brain drain. But in any case, the role of why is labor migration important? Yeah, it seems that labor export is among the most important export industries of the region, and what it means is also a very high influx of remittances, and they change both microeconomic and macroeconomic environment. Microeconomic in the sense that households, actually, the labor supply of households and their income status changes in rather complex ways if there is a household member who is abroad, and then in macroeconomic terms, of course, it is a huge boost to the current accounts, and it enables countries to run trade deficits much higher than they would have otherwise be able to do. Then another important feature is a large informal sector. So this is, again, as we presented, something that is unique, and we get the actually estimates of informal employment, which are quite conservative, because they are based on labor force surveys and on basically binary classification. So if somebody works in both informally and informally, he or she is classified as formal worker. But this is not the case if the size of informal economy is measured, because then, you know, the in theory value added could be divided between formal and informal of the same person. So in that sense, the informal sectors in the region are excessively high, and the estimates are that they are between 25 and 40%. And informal economy is, of course, it is high as a consequence of general lack of demand for jobs or the existence of a modern sector. But it is also high because of policies that are being pursued, and most significantly, at least that's what we got in a recent research, by high labor taxes, and actually all other taxes, but labor taxes are the feature that actually crowds out a lot of labor intensive low wage businesses. Then there is a lot of attention paid to labor market institutions and the way they are designed, and this is the approach that comes from the development countries framework. Since OECD's job study in 1993, there is an idea that labor market institutions in Europe initially were rigid, and that if they would be flexibilized, then European unemployment would the problem would be reduced. So, out of that approach, a very large literature emerged, and not only that, but also this became a guiding principle for. Most governments in the world, and so these are the basically aspects of institutional aspects that are always looked at if let's say somebody comes to inspect countries like IMF or somebody else, then they will look at the labor legislation, especially employment protection legislation, including also work time arrangements. Then also at the set of rules related to the minimum wages, trade unions and collective bargaining, also the labor taxes and unemployment benefits and social assistance programs. Now I will briefly move to the precisely to that issue. How do international organizations now look at the region? So what do they see as the main troubles and their recommendations at what should be done to reduce the levels of unemployment in the region? For example, the new World Bank Europe Central Asia study, the set of recommendations is the same for all countries. It specifies that it is important to enable private sector-led job creation. Then importance of skills for these new good jobs. Then the importance of reducing work desensitives in tax and social protection. And this is where, for example, three countries from the region are singled out as outliers in a negative sense. And also, quite surprisingly, removing obstacles to internal migration. So that's something that is, let's say, shift in their discourse, because and also potential clash with the EU policies of more harmonized regional development. This is how IMF, for example, looks now. This is an official study, but for example, signed by the chief negotiator with the Balkan countries. So there is a sort of, at least from that point of view, official aspect. And this is so-called heat map. Everything that is seen as red is problematic, and it should be cool somehow. So what is interesting is that despite the fact that there is a strong, some would say, ideological pressure, especially from the IMF, but also when it comes to the World Bank, to apply the flexibilization policies in the labor market, so to deregulate, to basically to make a business, to create a business friendly labor legislation. Now there is in this assessment there is a sort of honest recognition that the aspects related to the more general structural issues are the most problematic. The another half that I did not put here is shows the comparator countries, and they are always new member states and also some better developed former Soviet Union countries. So in any case, the progress in general reforms is something that is really missing in the region. There is also emphasis on the role of remittances, which are classified as structural factors. Then, when it comes to labor market institutional factors, we see that they do not represent, according to the IMF assessment, much of an obstacle. And then when it comes to labor costs, they indeed represent a significant obstacle when it comes to Serbia and Bosnia and Herzegovina. And in another development, just I will briefly mention another IMF research study discovered the importance of distribution decrease in inequality as something which is important for growth in developing countries. So this would reflect a sort of discourse shift that is quite remarkable for such an institution. This is one example of I would say missed opportunity. This is the Regional Cooperation Council Strategy 2020 for the Western Balkans region, and the strategy. So Regional Cooperation Council should be uniquely positioned to look at the specificities of the region and to capture something that comes from inside, not from the outside. But then what we have is a full emulation of Europe 2020 strategy. So that's a, you know, there is a vision to have 1 million more jobs, and there are four pillars which are basically the same as in the Europe 2020 strategy, with an addition of, I think, I cannot now recall, but probably somewhat differentiated treatment of the role of governance, which got more prominence. So, concluding on international advice, we can say that it is, of course, benevolent and very useful, but recommendations are based on broad generalizations, and advice tends to be fragmented or prone to general shifts in discourses, sometimes fashions. I don't have time to show the actual analysis of the EU progress reports. From year to year, the emphasis shifts and the recommendations disappear and then appear again in a couple more years. For example, now at some point labor taxes in taxes just much before the IMF and discovered it were singled out as one of important problems. But then they disappear now and are being replaced with skills mismatches as something that gets most prominence and most points. So that's really also shows that there is no enough persistence in pursuing actually those progress reports. Now, what do the governments do? They missed to identify employment as something which is really crucial for the development of these regions, and labor market regulations were at the start perceived as impediments to growth, so they should be deregulated and labor market would flourish. So that might have been a sort of initial idea, which did not happen. But then they have efforts to improve scores in global rankings, and this, as you know, is relatively easy to do. Macedonia is ahead of Switzerland, and Georgia ahead of Germany, so in doing business, for example, but. Then also at later stages, employment strategies are being adopted, but governments do not integrate them into their central strategies, nor into their fiscal frameworks. And the recent ad hoc policies include, for example, subsidies for foreign direct investment, efforts to improve scores in global rankings, as I mentioned, tax dumping, anti-immigration policies when it comes to seasonal workers. This is what Montenegro does sometimes. Then now the most recent developments, the workfare policies. Then also traineeships for university graduates to address youth unemployment, to create a local version of youth guarantee and so on. Okay, moving to a framework for a political economy of non-employment in the Western Balkans. Again, just to briefly mention previous efforts in this area. They were not surprisingly inspired by the varieties of capitalism approach. So the, you know, these are usually edited volumes where author, an expert of a certain region, tries to fit the region into a set framework, and varieties of capitalism approach actually was developed having in view trying to compare liberal market economies and coordinated or continental market economies, and it is simply the those dimensions are able to capture some of the reality of less developed or hybrid capitalist or emerging capitalist economies, but not all of them. So that the if you put a firm in the center of that political economy framework, it is totally justified in a setting of the U.S. or Japan. But if you do it in countries in which private sector is underdeveloped, then this is not, this bears not the same weight. And so, but still, of course, within the given coordinates, Will Bartlett tentatively at that time put Croatia and Macedonia into coordinated market economies. Of course, everything comes with a twist and a huge disclaimer, and in that writing as well. Then Albania and Kosovo more look like liberal market economies or potential liberal market, and Serbia and Montenegro following Mediterranean model. Let us get briefly back to that issue of relative of the worst unemployment record actually in the Western Balkans, and juxtapose it with relative political and social stability. So we see that we have the world's worst labor market indicators and still no dramatic manifestations of discontent. So the next worst region, is for example the one that had huge popular uprisings basically a couple of years ago. Then also, even more surprisingly, election outcomes favor incumbents. Not perfectly, but, you know, even if you look at Serbia and you think there is almost a regime change, but it came in steps which included basically the interim government before the current one was composed of the members of the Tadic government and of the Serbian Progressive Party, and even now it includes them. So more or less it favors incumbents in Macedonia, in Montenegro notoriously, and so on. So could we talk about the political economy of patience in the region, in this, in the well, again, in the sense of Albert Hirschman's tunnel metaphor or office concepts early in transition? I think not really, because people are actually not satisfied and do not see the end of that tunnel. Life in Transition survey, EBRD, shows that that again, the people in the region are the least satisfied if we compare them with both Central Europe and Baltics and former Soviet Union and Mongolia group of countries. And they're the least optimistic about the future, with the exception of Albania, which comes somewhere in the middle. So what I offer as a basically food for thought at this moment is something that I call tentatively exit loyalty political economy framework, in which there is a basically political economy system in which of which side effect is the highest non-employment in the world, in which there are two important exits: external in the sense of immigration and internal through informality and or marginalization, in which voice in that Hirschman metaphor rather than framework is silenced by broadening both exit and loyalty options, and in which loyalty is rewarded. And this is a departure from Hirschman's model, because in Hirschman's model loyalty is more related to patience, in a sense that you do not want to raise your voice because you still believe that either the director or the president would make a right move. So in this sense, loyalty is more a reward or even a bribe to the a large public sector, typically. It also involves the Weberian notion of political capitalism when it comes to private sector, because again, firms do not prosper largely because they're more productive and more successful in the market, but through their crony connections. And then in the basically democratic context of this region, free elections more or less, there is a need for even for wider distributional coalitions in order to reach median voter and to stay in power, if this is a goal. So those wider coalitions, it depends, but they might include pensioners, other social strata, even horizontal groupings like regions, certain regions, and some minorities. What would be the government size in this exit loyalty framework? Well, in order to reward or to bribe, you need to have a very large government expenditures, especially or only if you rely mostly on loyalty. And this really happens, and so that would be the two variants, I would say, of the system: one relying mostly on loyalty, another relying mostly on exit. And that relying mostly on loyalty actually would have to have very high government expenditures, and they indeed are high. In Serbia, they are now, given the crisis, almost 50%, and in Bosnia and Montenegro also well above, I think only Montenegro would be around European average, but others are, but well above, for example, what is average for new member states. And then it could be modest if relying mostly on exit, and then the governments and the states are poor, so they cannot afford so much rewards, but then they can facilitate more exits. And this is the case in Macedonia, Albania, and Kosovo. When it comes to immigration and remittances in this framework, then the situation should be the opposite, in the sense that larger size of immigration and larger share of remittances in GDP should be in countries which rely mostly on exit. And this is indeed the case. If we look at although the data are notoriously also sort of not quite reliable, but then we still know that remittances in Bosnia, Albania, Kosovo, and Macedonia are very, very high. Some estimates go to 20% in Bosnia and perhaps in other countries. And then they are around 10% in Serbia and Montenegro. And similarly to this external exit option, informal exit is or should be higher in the subgroup of countries relying mostly of exit, which indeed is the case, because there is more pressure to formalize, to finance a more expensive state in case of loyalty countries. And then also in this framework, public sector rewards should be higher in loyalty countries, which we also have some empirical evidence that this is the case. There is even a funny side effect of that public sector wage advantage that Serbia has, championing the public sector wage advantage at the same time is the champion of as in terms of lowest gender pay gap in Europe. And then there is a high spending and relatively generous social insurance programs in Serbia, Montenegro, and Bosnia. So pensioners should be better off relatively in these countries than in exit countries. Then also in all countries we can notice horizontal character of redistribution, even more so in loyalty countries. All countries championed a very primitive version of flat tax with high social security contributions, so the labor taxes are in general also very high. And also there was a damping in relation to corporate taxes. And bulk of tax revenues comes from indirect taxes, just like in least developed countries. Then expenditures on programs which involve transfers between income deciles are very low. So social active labor market programs make up 0.1% on average of GDP, and social assistance programs are also very low. For example, in Bosnia, pre and post transfer poverty rate hardly actually change. Or in Serbia, it has just been discovered in 2013 that Serbia has the highest relative poverty rate in Europe because of highest inequality. So a country which spends 50% through the government has at the same time the highest inequality in Europe, with a Gini of coefficient of 0.38. And some of my colleagues are trying to play it down by claiming that this is that poverty rate, relative poverty rate, is not so important as a ROP, at risk of poverty indicator, in which we are not the worst country in Europe, but perhaps the second last or something. Then also child poverty is higher than old age poverty. So this is another indicator of that character of the distribution. Now, what could we say about the costs and perspective of exit loyalty political economies? Of course, if we remember the graph showing that for those between 25 and 65, almost 20 years they work and 20 they do not, this is a huge waste of human capital. Then the system in which basically non-employment or inactivity dominates employment is also prone to economic stagnation and crisis, and will have sluggish long-term growth rates. It should also be inherently unstable, but it also can show, and that's possibly even worse, signs of strong inertia because of exit-driven vicious circles. So if there is no if the worsening of economic conditions creates more exit, especially if this is external exit, so it reduces changes it reduces chances for a change in the second iteration. And then when we look now, when we differentiate between the loyalty and exit groups, those big spenders are perhaps more vulnerable, especially now in short term, because of fiscal sustainability issues. And they might be still less vulnerable in long term because of demographic decline. Although in demographic terms, the countries will converge, and Kosovo will remain the only non-aging country until mid-century, and Albania will join soon the group of ex-Yugoslav countries. So simply, that is also a danger, because that's another variant of lump of labor fallacy, in the sense that you cannot think of that you would solve the unemployment problem by reducing the population by a quarter, because those that will leave probably wouldn't be able to work for the rest. So the region as a whole might become trapped in secular stagnation if it does not find an exit solution from this exit loyalty framework. Okay, thank you for your attention.
Thanks very much. It's a very innovative sketch of a model there, which I think we can discuss. Questions? Bernard?
To what extent does one find that employment as a consequence of transition and as a consequence of political change, that employment levels have dropped remarkably from what they were maybe two decades ago? And this is something which one saw certainly in Central and Eastern Europe. And yet, at the same time, one was retaining things like pension systems, which were presuming employment, high levels of employment, and that there are people now who are kind of drawing from structures which dated from the past, but actually are finding themselves in a situation which is the present. In other words, people are being given these things like pensions because the system allows them, they've generated an entitlement to a pension, but there is nobody, because employment levels have dropped, who are reproducing and refinancing that system. So this seems to be part of the inertia that you're talking about. Can you comment upon that?
Yeah. This is a very relevant point, of course this is inertia which, as you know, also has its its legal aspects, and Serbia and other countries of former Yugoslavia had a well established Bismarckian system, and that is also the reason for keeping social security, especially pension insurance, contributions at a very high level. And in general, there is a very, with the exception of Kosovo, which actually had started from scratch and decided something that was out of necessity, but that probably is also the approach that should be preferred if one is to actually try to promote employment. But then all other countries are really quite conservative in that respect, and that simply a sort of, you do not have a critical thinking about the pension system. Everybody actually, you know, even again, I will refer to Serbia because this is where the situation is the most dramatic, and I know it best. You know, the entire discourse is the following, including from the IMF, but now speaking about our experts, it is that the pay-as-you-go system is the only system, and pensioners' rights are sacred. So, you know, these are the premises that everybody accepts, and groups like Fiscal Council, which advocates the reduction in pensions, are not advocating the regime change in pensions. They are still for the pay-as-you-go system, and also there, for example, in the recent we just had a cut in pensions, which could be considered a step in the right direction, because it basically cuts the pensions above. It is totally counter-constitutional, so unconstitutional, so that's another problem which we may face, but it retains the level of pensions up to a certain level of minimum pension, average pension actually, and then above it reduces. We do not know if it is a tax or not. I think that's a problem, that it simply cuts the pension, but there is no legal basis for it, so this is trouble ahead. By 22, and then higher pensions even by 25%. So it is an ad hoc progressive taxation of pensions, which is being done in basically not in a way that could be easily questioned by the Constitutional Court, and still this approach is pragmatic. It is not based on an idea that our pension system is not sustainable and that we should be heading toward a sort of base old age pension with some modifications, perhaps for those who earned more during their working time. But no, there is no. I think in the countries there is no thinking about that.
Besna.
Yes, thank you very much for a very interesting presentation. I think it raises all kinds of questions. But to me, your starting point that really what is interesting is not just the job situation, but is the quality of jobs that have been created in the region is equally important. That to me kind of resonates very much with how I look at the region when it comes to this unsavory post-transition employment record. And I think both aspects are related to the type of growth model that has been pursued in the region. And you talked about various aspects of that model, but one aspect you didn't address is the role of FDIs. And I think that is... And then that's linked to another point you made about the poor quality of labor statistics in general. So my question is, do we know more about these job generation patterns as they relate to FDA jobs and homegrown jobs? Because I just come from a research trip in the region talking to some cases of a successful, quite successful FDI takeovers, and I was quite struck by the issue of quality of jobs that have been created. So that's one question on FDI versus homegrown. And the other one is to do with regional variation, because we often hear about quite general explanations about what government is doing in terms of employment policies. But what I find is that there is quite a lot of in-country regional variation when it comes to job generation. So is there more information on that aspect as well? Can you tell us a little bit more from your research? Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. When it comes to the role of FDIs in job creation, you are right. It is impossible to generate separate statistics from the type of the surveys that are now being mostly used, and these are the basically household-based surveys. But it is potentially possible. I am not aware that there is such data available. It is potentially possible from establishment surveys. There is a preserved RAD survey in most of the countries. Additional trouble with that survey is that it actually has not been replenished or did not for quite some time, in the sense that those firms that survived socialism, they remained in the sample of large firms. That, for example, if someone, some new firm comes, then they are not, they do not enter, or at least not immediately, do not enter the sample. So the these are basically the information that are collected through the establishment service, through the RAD service, and in theory, it would be possible. From what I know, for example, again, mostly from Serbia, you can get some partial but still good quality information from chambers of commerce active in the countries. For example, German Chamber of Commerce, the German investment in Serbia are quite large among the firms which do not really enter even that establishment survey, because they are small individually, but then there are many of them, and such a research would be very interesting. What I suspect that but then there are also gray zones, and gray zones are related to the so-called foreign investment that are, for example, local money laundered abroad and then reinvested, and then also the gray zones in terms of mixed ownership of certain firms. So that's not. But in general, what the areas in which the region had the most investment are not those generated. Expected to generate most jobs and expected to fit the overall quality of the labor force. Because what we think of our countries is that we have a good education and that our workers actually cannot find jobs fit to their qualification. But in reality, the region is at the bottom when it comes to employment levels. So we trail the EU 15 in terms of very much in terms of higher educated people and new member states in terms of share of people with secondary education. So again, solving unemployment problem would also should involve, for example, you know, retaining parts of textile industry, food processing industry, and things that actually have happened in our eastern neighborhood in Romania and Bulgaria. You know, during transition, they were able to attract labor-intensive investment, and in this region, in my opinion, also the negative role of labor taxes was important. We didn't succeed in that. And when it comes to regional differences, yes, they are extremely pronounced. There is one can think of Belgrade as a vibrant European center, and then just going north, surprisingly, 50 kilometers, you find areas basically which are desperately stuck in a sort of regression, half deserted areas of Banat in eastern Vojvodina, and also eastern Serbia is that populated. And then there is that sort of huge area of basically poverty encompassing mountain regions, Macedonia, Kosovo, Albania, Montenegro, parts of Bosnia. So, you know, so that's well known. And so that's why, for example, I was surprised to learn that the World Bank now recommends for people from such regions simply to move to regional centers. And I mean, it to a degree, it is a sensible strategy. You know, it is very expensive to keep a school having two teachers and two pupils, which happens in many areas of Balkans.
I think what I was suggesting, for example, in Bosnia, is quite interesting when you look at cases of privatization in manufacturing industry, mm-hmm. how regionally it varies, you know, how in some areas, in some cantons, which are administrative units in Bosnia, you have quite proactive governments who've done very good job, and then in other cases you have complete hands-off approach vis-a-vis for investors. So, you know, that makes the whole story of Bosnian state not having adequate response slightly more complex than it seems.
Oh, definitely.
This is what...
No, definitely. Bosnia is a fantastic natural experiment because you have, you know, one country, two large policy units, and then also many more subunits.
Vasilis.
Michal, I want to start from the last point you made about the education levels. What I wanted to ask was that, you know, sort of thinking in terms of political economy, in terms of modeling, voice and loyalty, I think one has to have a good explanation of why employment or non-employment was low or employment was high to start with, because I think the model tells us about why this is maintained as a exchange between means of corruption and violence, but doesn't actually tell us much about why non-employment is so high. And I wanted to say the point that you said, that it is not just that, you know, that demand is not so vibrant, it's obviously not, and that the quality of jobs is not particularly good. It is also a problem of labor quality. And labor quality in both respects, both of the education and skills kind of aspect that you mentioned, but also in terms of, if you want, motivation, reservation wages, willingness to migrate, willingness to move across occupations. So in that sense, labor supply is very, well, in relative terms, low quality and quite rigid. And I wonder whether, so what I'm trying to say is that then I would feel more comfortable with the political economic explanation if the starting problem is a demand problem. So if there was low demand and governments had an incentive not to invest too much in good FDI policies and stuff, and they just wanted the machines in order to hand out money to the clientele. But if it's a supply side problem, then there's in a way less scope for a political economy explanation, although very sympathetic political economy explanations. But yeah, so what is the response to that?
Yeah. It would be interesting also, this is of course an extremely important point, and it would be interesting to look further into the structures of those who, for example, have left and those who remain, and also to the basically the changes in their labor supply behavior, but also behind that, and there is some research actually that have done that. The entrepreneurship inclinations of families which are migrants. So this is one aspect. I mean, I'm always sort of very reserved to involve education and even labor force quality into such a framework, because it's extremely complex. It's people make decisions about their education having in mind their options for, according to human capital theory, for 50 years ahead. So and also the migration is only extension or another variant of human capital theory. So this is, I mean, it simply needs to be researched further. I agree that it's important, but I do not have at this moment answer to that.
Yeah, this question.
I have a question, and you kind of talked about this maybe in the previous session. Mm-hmm. How can job creation be enhanced in the future, and what? And how can this be supported by international assistance programs? And also, we know that low-income earners are more inclined to informality, and this is particularly true because the tax wedge is really high for low-income earners. So how can, through taxation, they can formalize the work? Because as far as I had research done in an industrial zone in Macedonia, employers are actually complaining of unavailability of labor, not just poor labor. They say we can do on-the-job training, but we don't have any labor interested to be integrated in our sectors. So how can this be helped, especially for labor-intensive sectors?
Well, this is a question well favored by international consultant, so I have ready-made answers to that. but indeed, there is more to it, of course, and out of that magician's pocket, I can say, of course, reducing labor taxes is what I've been advocating for a long time. Then also, basically, you know. A little bit inconsistent, but starving the beast of the large government, which actually doesn't serve the purpose, because large government, if there exists, it should provide services, it should reduce inequality, it should promote cohesion and jobs, but they do not do that. So making the governments more responsible and effective would be sort of a more general demand. And then when it comes to labor market policies, as I said, labor taxes are more important than for example labor legislation. There is a always it's good to have relatively flexible and clear legislation, but I do not expect much from, for example, recent changes in Serbian labor code, which have been advertised as a solution to our economic problems. Inclusive policies which for example, I'm more for more active labor market policy. Workfare is not a solution because it's, of course, cynical to pay a pittance in terms of social assistance and then to expect that people really live off it. But then also some things could be tested, although I'm there might be problems, but for example invert benefits is something that also could be tested and which always actually meets the resolute no from the social policy ministries.
Dennis, trying to
get back in. I'm attracted by this notion of inertia. I want to try and move away from merely looking at the West Balkans, because a lot of what you describe seems to me to be very familiar from somewhere which I know better, which is Germany and the Eastern states of Germany. So that you get again this sort of the expectations which are built upon previous systems, what people had, what they expected, and a lot of what you describe, but maybe perhaps to a slightly lesser extent, I would suggest that you find there as well, and it'd be worth looking a bit wider than merely the West Balkans, which I actually agree is not an homogenous area. I mean, you know, kind of we sit here and sort of from Europe and we talk about something called Latin America and people sort of tell us problems about Latin America that it's not Latin America. And equally, I think, you know, if you went to Latin America, people talk about Europe next. So, yes, there is something called, there is some area there. It is not an homogenous area like that which came out of this. But I think that you can learn lessons. It's not a sui generis sort of state of affairs. You could see it somewhere else, and I wonder whether you could also not see it if you went around to certain parts of, say, the north east or the northwest of this country, or if you went to certain places in the United States. I mean, sort of get some about West Virginia, and you would actually see again exactly the same problems, and the same problems are all associated with this concept of inertia, and some of the points of stress in these points of place seem to be pertinent to that.
Thank you. That's really, really great if you found something more universal than I thought it could be.
So you're trying to explain the very low labour market performance in the Western Balkans.
Yes, but then again, I agree. But, you know, of course, everybody starts from more or less own experience. So I would possibly think more in terms of extending this to the country's experience now, large emigration and new adjustment like Bulgaria and Romania and even other new member states are having this situation, and of course within a certain country like Germany, that's also quite possible. But I agree that could be a matter of degree when it comes to explaining Bulgaria, Romania, and the Western Balkans. But then going further, my guess would be that it would require a more sort of general theoretical approach than this one that I'm offering, trying to to pin down what's specific for this very region.
Some people say that it's all to do with emigration because, as you mentioned, the immigrants are sending remittances home, and that's driving up the reservation wage, and that's why you can't find people to work, and why people are happy to, you know, sit in the cafe rather than go to the labour exchange across the road. Is that?
Yeah, that's the standard, basically the theoretical expectation of the impact of remittances, is that they should decrease labour supply of the receiving households, and that they should raise reservation wage, and then also that they should bring people out of poverty if they are households, so they should reduce poverty. And then there has been quite a number of I hope I would be able to read all of them until the end of my stay here, but quite a number of recent research on the role of remittances in the region, in comparative, for example, Macedonia, Kosovo and Bosnia, then in the new setup Serbia and Macedonia, then Albania has perhaps the widest literature on that. And then what emerges is a very complex from the research, which is mostly based either on specific surveys, specially design surveys, or on that has to be it, or on labor force surveys. So that sort of household-based service which are able to capture behaviors. So they are very, very varied. They have very varied results. In some cases, the result is that receiving remittances increases labor supply, or at least increases entrepreneurship inclinations, because it enables people with money. So Albanian studies are mostly either neutral or find either neutral or positive role of remittances with respect to labor supply, which is again strange, but
that includes self-employment.
Includes self-employment. Yeah.
Did the crisis actually because it certainly happened in some places, that sort of they were actually reverse problems.
Yes.
Was there any sort of permanence of this, or in fact were those getting temporary reverse flows, or was anything brought back? I mean, if returning workers bring back something, this is another, this is the dynamic nature of external migration. It's not just the money that they actually come.
They come and they open, for example, a small shop or do something that they've learned. So that also involves a skill transfer, reverse skill transfer. So these are all very, very interesting things. And indeed, since there is a number of newer research, they try to capture even the impact of the crisis. In Bosnia, Nermin Orlović actually did a research in which he shows that in 2007, the transfers were mostly from well-off to the well-off, you know, basically as it is called, exchange transfers, meaning that you send money to your family either to pay off the money that they borrowed you, or to start your business in which you will have some interest. But then in 2011 it changed to the altruistic transfers, where you help your family to survive, and there is actually quite a lot of research in that area that should somehow feed the structure, the skeleton that I try to.
Okay. Well. Thanks very much. I think we've had a very good presentation and discussion, and I have to bring the proceedings to a close now because we've run out of time, and I'd just like to announce that the next seminar will be in a couple of weeks' time on the 18th of November, and Joanna Hansen will be talking about, she's a visiting, also a visiting fellow at LISI, on about the Belgrade Pristina normalisation agreement. And then shortly after that, on the 1st of December, we have a panel discussion on the Romanian presidential elections. So there's plenty more interesting seminars and events to come. Thanks very much.